I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. And this is the iconic voice of jazz. How differently do we hear it today?
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me.
A lot of black female entertainers suffer from a lack of appreciation from this culture.
I do feel the independence, the sense of history, and she was just unflinching.
I think people still love her because you can put her on anywhere, anytime, and it just pierces right through.
We may never meet again on the bumpy road to love.
Billie Holiday's story back in the day, in her music, in her own autobiography, was the full catalog of suffering in a 20th century underground. Abandonment and child prostitution on the way to drink, drug addiction, and death at 44. Our astonishment at her centennial is hearing something entirely other in that one-off blue voice. Janice Pendarvis, Dominic Eade, Marissa Nadler, our performers, teachers, citizens of music world today.
It really, for me, in light of the things that are happening right now, you know, the whole massacre in Charleston, it puts some things in perspective.
On re-listening in 2015, Billie Holiday stands for virtually unflawed mastery in the old art of song. Some would argue, she was the only perfect jazz singer that ever was. It's her 100-year milestone and John Sweat's meditation on Billie Holiday, the musician and the myth, that prompt this hour re-experiencing the sound and the story inside it. John Sweat is a musical biographer of Alan Lomax and Miles Davis before this. I read him as an anthropologist with huge ears. His book touches the rise of jukeboxes, the refinement of microphones, Harlem and the Depression, the voices of Sophie Tucker, Ethel Waters, Louis Armstrong, and Frank Sinatra, among others, that shaped an era. Also the three stages of Billie Holiday herself, finding her way through jazz, blues, and the best of the American songbook to what can only be called Billie Holiday's songs, the shocker, strange fruit, above all, about lynching. Her showbiz persona emerged full-grown in a tiny Harlem club in 1933. She was just 18 when the talent scout John Hammond heard her, and Benny Goodman asked to accompany her on clarinet.
What we know about her life before that point is just a series of horror stories in which singing is not part of it. The first job she went for was to be a dancer. She wasn't thinking of singing. She lucked out, apparently, when she couldn't dance. They said, well, can you sing at least? And she sang, and the crowd was, according to at least some memories, weeping by the time she got through with the song. If you listen to her very first recording, the first two sides she did, she sounds way too high-pitched. And she said, I sound like a child, which is true. And she's almost shouting because she wasn't used to a microphone. But then within days, she did a film with Duke Ellington in which her whole self is in place, which is absolutely stunning to me.
Saddest tale on land or sea was when my man walked out on me.
People have said so many times that enough already about her tortured life. Let's talk about her art, which we want to do with you, John. At the same time, part of her art was assembling, inventing this story of herself, including an autobiography. And you're marvelous on the point that a great deal of it was made up. It was myth. It was a kind of novelized version of herself. But it endures, and it's going to endure maybe forever, as a statement. Talk about that. The myth maker in this singer.
The problem of Holiday is that by the time white people heard of her. She already had a record, the other kind of record, a police record, and was into various kinds of problems, by 46 for sure. So there was no way that could be hidden. It had to be part of her narrative. So how was she going to, what could she do? And in her own book, she seems to, not so much lie, as people have said, but to leave out things. She doesn't want to tell you part of her life. Holiday, if she was building a myth, she wasn't going so far as to say that she had been sanctified and so forth, even though she was, as she put it, a religious bitch all her life.
Hmm. You quote that famous beginning, or opening line in her autobiography. She said, "Mom and Pop were just a couple of kids when they got married. He was 18, she was 16, and I was 3. She got everything wrong. The numbers and the marriage, they never did get married, but the process was underway. What was she driving toward?
You're talking about Lady Sings the Blues, her autobiography, which was written just before, the 2 years before she died. Well, that book serves many purposes and many functions. It was partly to make some money because she was broke. It's partly to get her cabaret license back that the police had taken away from her as a felon so she could work again. It's partly to sell books. I mean, these are all separate drives and separate goals, and they don't mesh quite well. And if I can say something that I always like to give critics credit, a New Yorker writer, Richard Brody, pointed out that Lady Sings the Blues is an indictment of the United States in the 1950s. It's drug laws, it's prison laws, it's handling of artists, it's color lines and so forth. And he's absolutely right. She talks about not being able to get drug treatment in a public hospital because it was forbidden in New York, that doctors weren't supposed to, but from 1914 or 11 or 10, new drug laws made it impossible to be part of a treatment of an addict. Mm. And so people were all going cold turkey or not going cold turkey and continuing on. It's about how prisons put junkies in jail with no treatment. It's about giving her a year and a day sentence because they knew that if it was slightly over a year, she wouldn't be able to travel. Her passport would be lifted. It's all those things, and it's hard to say that any of them are dominant.
With bloom everywhere.
I like everything Richard Rohde wrote about your book, John. He said, "I'd characterize her book, Lady Sings the Blues, as a Dickensian piece. It depicts a life lived in a pathologically, brazenly, unrepentantly, systematically, and casually racist country." Does it stand up as true? I mean, is it the lie that tells the truth?
I wish I'd written that. The more complicated thing, she thinks, this doesn't turn up in most of the books about her, but she thought her father died because he couldn't get into a hospital because he was black and he couldn't get into white military hospital.
Well, story that was the Bessie Smith story.
Right, it's the Bessie Smith. And neither of the stories turned out to be true, but she believed it and repeated it. And I've got to think that every black family would have had those fears. They may have them now, that whether they get the treatment or not. So many things that are almost minor throwaways in her book really carry enormous moral weight behind them. This is where I want to say that I think she's trying to make a case. It's not in your face all the time, but it's there, that people who are despised or marginalized, like prostitutes, maids, blues singers, as being immoral, as being wanton, as being trash, they have their own kind of values, their own morals, and that she was going to say what those were, the morals of dignity, of survival.
He's the lowest man
of telling the truth
that I've ever seen.
Survival was enough as it was, but they had their own honor and dignity, and she was going to make the case for them. And some of the things that never got into her autobiography were things about the police having sweeps of prostitutes early in the morning in Harlem, in which they swept in maids going to work. Most singers carried weapons. The women singers, they carried pistols and razors and knives and stuff. Billy carried safety razors in her Kleenex box she kept beside her.
Richard Brody said in admiration of your book, John, "Billie Holiday, like all great artists, is as distinctive, as idiosyncratic, as original offstage and off mic as on. The life does not explain the art. Rather, the life is an art in itself."
I think it's a good point. A life and an art are running side by side, but one is not creating the other. you're not simply saying, I'm telling you all the things happened to me on one hand, and you're not saying, I can tell you about those things because they happened to me. In fact, what she said on that was that I can only sing songs that I feel, but there's some songs I feel so strongly I can't sing them. And then she says, but that's another story. And I it's plagued me since then. What were the songs that she couldn't sing because they were too painful? I'm guessing Love for Sale was one of them, since she only did it once.
All the while, glittering stars fell madly on Billie Holiday's world. Orson Welles, making his masterpiece, Citizen Kane, in 1941, was drawn to the jazz singer in Hollywood. My Little Brown Baby, he called her later. The poet Elizabeth Bishop wrote four songs for a colored singer that she hoped Billie would get to sing. Jack Kerouac, the beat hero of On the Road, wanted to write about Billie as the heroine of the hip generation. Coming up, the musical gift inside that mystique. Here are Dominic Eade and her protege, Rebecca Sullivan, pinpointing just one of the lessons out of the book of Billie Holiday.
Them Their Eyes, for instance, where I think she really takes so much from Louis Armstrong, who she said was such a big influence. Instead of singing, I fell in love with you the first time I looked into, she sings it all on one note.
I fell in love with you the first time I looked into.
She completely flattens out the melody. I mean, I think flattens is the wrong word for it, because she really distills the melody into its essential line.
Really underscoring the swinging rhythm and also the language contour.
My heart is jumping, you started something with them eyes.
Right, the punchline then becomes much more highlighted, and it's like a little rhythmic trumpet riff that she sings the words on.
I don't know how to describe it, really. It's just like this amazing balancing act between control and this dangerous kind of freedom.
This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Listening to Billie Holiday as if for the first time in her 100th birthday year.
Life is lived in that space between the notes, you know, and that's what you hear when she's moving in that way where, you know, people call it like blue notes, but for her, to me, with her, it goes beyond that.
Janice Pendarvis from the Oscar-winning documentary 20 Feet from Stardom about the great backup singers teaches at the Berklee College of Music in Boston.
One of the fascinating things about Billie Holiday, and I guess in some ways for me the most fascinating thing about the art and craft of what she does as a singer, is that she is a master at using pitch, intonation, as an interpretive element. When I was a little kid and I used to hear my parents play Billie Holiday, I used to think, why do they like her? She's out of tune.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
As I grew older and got to appreciate the richness of how she interpreted every lyric, I then started to realize that the way that she sang, you know, made those little bends and twists and turns through the notes, that was part of the genius.
The late Gunther Schuller, man of all musics and prolific on the subject of Billie Holiday, liked to say that her voice had the reedy timbre of an English horn. She
She modeled her phrasing on horn players, and she sang with the very best of them, Louis Armstrong, and most memorably, Lester Young and Ben Webster. But there was never a whisper of cue the girl singer. John Sweat, in his centennial reconsideration, makes it a central point that Billie Holiday in her 20s was an equal among giants in small group sessions that launched her in the 1930s.
There were no solo singers working outside of opera and the like. You couldn't just book a singer and say, this person is so big they'll draw an audience, which seems strange, but then it's in the same period where instrumentals were more important than singers. If you look at the pictures, huge crowds of people would gather around the instrumentalist, and the singers were sort of off to the side, and they were called boys and girls, the boys singer and the girls singer. And so, Sinatra and a few other people broke through that, and Joe Stafford and the like. But that was a different era with a different aesthetic going, and I have no idea exactly why that's so, except that this music was so fresh, particularly to white people, that it was frissante, as in get it. It's shocking, okay? If you read the French talking about early jazz, it's like they've been hit with divine bolts. They're knocked over, and they use the word futurist all over the place. You know, this is pure modernity, or more complicated, it's pure primitivism involved with modernity, and that's delicious, right?
Ooh, what a little moonlight can do.
So there is that to be said, that wonderful mix that surrealism was trying to get at, and scatting dada, you know, and scatting words. And forget about shocks from rock and roll or shocks from rap. We were already conditioned for this. The real shock was when everything was blown away, when women decided to cut their hair and not to wear underwear and smoke cigarettes and dance, where a white woman would break all the rules just by dancing, and they'd have a black band behind them. You know what I mean?
You'll get bold. You can't resist him and all you say. When you have kissed him, is ooh, what a little moonlight can do.
You get it in Fitzgerald. When Fitzgerald's talking about the echoes of the jazz age, Fitzgerald says, the dancers all were leaning on each other with their heads on their shoulders as if they'd been transformed. Something really powerful going on when European rhythms gave way to African rhythms. I think it was still going on in Holiday's time. I think it's still going on in our time.
John, speak of the art here.
There were small groups, and they were not rehearsed. They had no arrangements other than some discussion beforehand.
No leader, even.
No leader. And the reason they were even made, and this is, I think, critical, at the time they were, which is the mid-30s when the recording companies were collapsing, was that two things had happened. One was the jukebox had been invented, which brought something new into it, where a lot of people could hear music together in a restaurant or a bar. And black restaurants weren't getting, or clubs weren't getting music specific to them. John Hammond sold the idea to the company he worked for at the time. I can get these records made for those jukeboxes for $200 to $300 a session by using musicians who happen to be in town, but they'll be really great musicians with names, but they'll take the work. And we won't use any arrangements, no rehearsal time, no studio time. We'll be in and out of there fast. So that's the way they operated. And when you look back, you say, well, these people were, they knew each other. They were like a folk community of people. They may not have played, but they knew when you ended and started. They knew the tunes. They knew the chord changes. They knew what people were capable of. They knew how to put something together.
Me, myself, and I have just one point of view.
So a lot of this stuff sounds like, oh, here they come. They're playing all at the same time, but they're not crashing into each other. They know enough to know we can make this up as we go along and not crash. The background, the foreground could erase multiple perspectives, and you might say this is Cubism. This is Cubist music. It's the whole field of vision is changing in front of you. So when you hear Holiday with Lester Young, who's a very celebrated and famous combination, playing together a saxophone with a singer, it's not fixed. And as Lauren Schoenberg, the great saxophonist and museum curator, pointed out to me, sometimes she's singing the straight part and he's improvising. Sometimes she's improvising and he's playing the straight part. Sometimes they're both improvising. Sometimes they're both straight. This is really quite revolutionary, and yet it's coming out of a jukebox and people are saying, oh.
I love the Cubist idea, but background, foreground, they're improvising simultaneously, sort of trapeze artists flying blind.
Yeah, she's not following the sheet music, and you could say, well, a saxophonist could play with someone following the sheet music because he knows the music, but she's going off from it.
Me, myself, and I are all in love with you. We all think you're wonderful, we do. Me, myself, and I have just one point of view.
Is there another 30s tune in that mode that you want to speak about, John?
Well, No Regrets is always good.
Yeah, perfect.
Because it's so assertive.
No regrets, although our love affair has gone astray. No regrets, I know I'll always care, though you're away.
That's what they mean about the exuberant rhythm and the catatonic lyrics. Somebody's counted them up. Maybe it was you. I mean, she sang more upbeat, cheerful, lovey-dovey songs than blues.
No, I haven't done that, but it's perfectly believable. We just forget about it. On the other hand, who else had done a suicide song and a lynching song? That's enough to put you in the books right there.
Matter of miking here. Billie Holiday and Frank Sinatra get credit for using the microphone in a brand new way. In effect, speaking into a mic on their chest, into your ear is the way it comes out. What is Billie Holiday doing?
She seemed to have brought the Harlem cabaret aesthetic forward, which was you went table to table and you had no mics. That meant that you didn't have to shout over everybody like a Broadway singer, like an Ethel Merman or something, but you went table to table and people knew the song because it came around. You could also change your voice table to table, and you could do different things, flirt, insult, joke. Yeah, you could keep changing as you went. But it was a very close thing, and the clubs were very small. So were the 1950s nightclubs. They were all very small. Hollywood made them big, but they were never that big. They had no air conditioning. People were all sweating. So she's brought that aesthetic into play with the microphone. I'll Get By is interesting because it was done first by a whole bunch of stars who sold a lot of records and she didn't, but there's hers won out. Gunther Schuller noted of this that she does 20-some A notes in a sequence. When the song is going other places, she's sticking with that one note. This is a truly radical performance. She had a narrow range, at most an octave and a half, and she often is only using 5 and 6 notes in a song, which is kind of astonishing. Nobody today gets by with that narrow range. But it's what she does with the range that makes you not notice it.
I was thinking
I'll Be Seeing You is the one that's really in the cabaret stuff, partly because it's so slow.
your places that this heart of mine embraces all day through.
You can see her singing this one, Table to Table, John.
This is also a very slow song, and maybe one of the slowest songs ever recorded. And it's worth mentioning that slow is hard to do.
The children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well.
Maybe it's sort of, if you dare to be that slow, you're serious.
In every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay.
It's been said about Ben Webster on the tenor saxophone that he made the sound of a man breathing. It's kind of a clinical existential definition. Lauren Schoenberg says of Billie Holiday, she gave America the sound of an African-American woman talking, and it hadn't been heard before.
And all her pianists said something to the effect that she sang like she talked. They also say that she had the best time of anyone they ever worked with, and by time they meant she'll always be there. In some recordings, she's a bar and a quarter behind the song. And that may not mean anything to sit here and say that, except if you're there, your first impulse is she's lost. Holiday is not faultless, and yet you think she's faultless. Her singing was all about the emotion in the phrasing and in the presentation, but not in the purity of voice.
I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing.
Billie Holiday's material is often misremembered. She did not call herself a blues singer, and she didn't make it as a band singer with Count Basie or anybody else. What she sang most was the very best of Tin Pan Alley, the music of Jerome Kern, Irving Berlin, the Gershwins, and Harold Arlen. George Gershwin auditioned her to play and sing Bess in Porgy and Bess, and she made one of the first recordings of the classic Summertime. From the 1940s onward, she was finding her real voice, she said, inhabiting and helping to write songs that could only be hers. Torchier, more political, on American themes, but closer to the European art song.
Hello?
Sounds like Dee Dee Bridgewater.
This is Dee Dee Bridgewater speaking.
Them that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose.
The perfect Lady Day song, and why? I would say, the first song that comes in my head as the perfect Lady Day song is God Bless the Child.
Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
That song just makes, it says a lot about her as an individual, standing on her own.
Empty pockets don't ever make the grave.
I just think it tells a lot about Billie Holiday the person, you know, and how you've got to be self-reliant. You can't depend on other people. She said that the idea for the song was born out of her asking her mother one time for some money to help pay the rent, and her mother told her, you know, God bless a child that's got his own, Billie.
Lots of friends, they're crowding round your door. But when you're gone and spending ends, they don't come no more. Rich relations gear.
Coming up, Billie Holiday's place among the singers of sad songs. Our Ladies of Perpetual Sorrows, on the road to Janis Joplin and Amy Winehouse, a legacy still unfolding. This is Open Source.
Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In the realm of sad songs and singers, you could draw a plausible line from Billie Holiday's story to the notorious 27 Club of addicts and suicides in modern rock and pop. But then Marissa Nadler, in her own well-known melancholy vein, would say you'd be missing something about Billie Holiday and the healing power of sadness.
Sunday. My hours are slumberless. Dearest, the shadows I live with are numberless.
Gloomy Sunday is by far my favorite Billie Holiday song. I mean, it is the very top, and I've listened to it many, many, many times over the years, and I keep going back to it.
Of sorrow has taken you. Angels have no thought of ever returning you. Would they be angry if I thought of joining you?
The composer that initially wrote it, it was such a sad song that people, this may not be entirely accurate, but people that had committed suicide were found clutching the sheet music to the song, because it was just the saddest song in the world.
Gloomy is Sunday, with shadows I spend it all.
For me, listening to a sad song is not self-indulgent and morose and mopey, but it's the opposite. It's a healing antidote. And with her, it's not over the top. It's just the song. It's just her delivering it, and it is really pure.
That I'm glad to go. Death is no dream, for in death I'm caressing you.
I asked John Sweat, what about the stream of lady singers and their travails?
I'll be blessing you.
Well, they do have a kind of deified status. I mean, hey, I was trained in the social sciences. I start faltering here fast. It's gone through and say, call in a poet.
Randy Weston said about Billie Holiday, when I think of jazz, I think of people coming into nightclubs and hearing music that would make you feel very sad, very tender. Like Billie Holiday singing the blues, she could bring tears to your eyes, make you feel very sad, but at the same time, you would feel spiritually good.
You start out one way and you move the other way. I don't know, is there some parallel here to preachers? They start with the text and they depart from the text and it becomes
bring it home, we say.
Yeah. Turn the house out.
I don't know why, but I'm feeling so sad. I long to try something I've never had.
John, you've given us some wonderful outtakes from Lady Sings the Blues, things that didn't make the final cut. But speak of the very wary way that book was received in 1956, including by high priests like Whitney Balliot.
You're speaking of how the jazz people received
yeah.
it. Well, I mean, it's crude of me to say so, but these were high modernists. They were closet high modernists. They had a certain conception of what jazz was, and it had nothing to do with whorehouses in New Orleans. They had a kind of vision of this, like, I don't know, something like abstract expressionism. It was very pure in what it did. You know, it was about itself. And here comes this woman telling you, not only were there whorehouses, but she heard the music in one, and actually says, doesn't she? I must not have been the only person who ever learned about jazz in a whorehouse. I mean, they didn't want to hear this stuff. And they felt betrayed. Actually, some words were used like that. They said, we tried to clear all that stuff away. Jazz was a dirty word. We got it cleaned up, and here you come with this shack stuff and, you know, funky food and craziness. It really has a 50s kind of, you know, we're purifying this for the masses, I guess. We're making democracy safe for the masses.
And whisper sweet little things in my ears, hugging and kissing.
She was ahead of her time on race. She says, among many other things, when you're writing, straighten them out about my people. I'm a Negro. I've got 2 strikes against me. I'm proud of those 2 strikes. I'm as good as a lot of people of all kinds. I'm proud I'm a Negro. What did it mean to be a race woman, as she was?
Yeah, she actually used that phrase about herself once. She said, I'm a race woman, you know. And she was raising questions about how people would react to strange fruit. It was never about the politics of it. It was about, would this drive her out of singing, in effect? She had become so political that it wasn't about song anymore. But she never took that seriously. She just raised the question. People made a lot out of it.
Blow. Blow away. Let me rest today. You're blowing me no good. No good.
It's a common observation that by the late 1950s, Billie Holiday's voice was broken. By alcohol, it seemed. But not everybody agreed. Miles Davis and Billie, too, thought she was her best, essential self, recording her final album, Lady in Satin, with strings and a full orchestra.
I'm a fool to want you.
John, take on the last tough question. Is late, late Billie Holiday, and especially that Lady in Satin, high orchestration, broken voice, and still unbelievable power. Miles Davis said he felt she was stripped down to the essentials and better than ever at this point. That's a minority view, though.
There are people who were hurt by this album and say, how dare they allow this to be released, much less spend all that money on it was a death watch. It was a grotesque horror movie, all sorts of things. Other people in the audience, as you say, saw this as somehow the purest form of the singer not counting on voice at all to carry what she does. It was a very expensive thing to produce. Many takes were made. Very bad health, and was at some points propped up by a nurse or a woman acting as a nurse to make sure she didn't fall down. And then there was a sense always that the arrangements were designed to cover her faults, but I don't sense that in hearing it. I sense it's she's still bare inside of it.
Time and time.
I don't see where you could hide it. So they're not playing too loud. It's not bombastic. There's not a lot of emotion. In fact, that's what I always thought odd about people who didn't respect the album, including its producer and arranger, Ray Ellis. There are no instruments behind her improvising most of the time, or at all, really. And there's no heavy counter melodies that might cover things. So he's written a very bare thing rather than one that's trying to hide something.
So I walk a little too fast, and I drive a little too fast.
She thought it was the best record she ever made, and she modeled it, at least in her head, way back on Frank Sinatra's records with Nelson Riddle, and wanted Nelson Riddle. But when she heard Ray Ellis, she asked for him, and he was at Columbia, and they worked it out. But this was expensive. She didn't want to start till midnight or later, so they were on the clock for all these 40-some musicians coming in. And there are various things I've seen on the web that break down the musicians, you know, first chair musicians from the New York Philharmonic, first chair jazz people. It's an all-star show. So you have to find this interesting, at least if you find yourself shocked by it.
Do they know? Do they care that it's only...
The other thing is that she's closely mic'd by very modern equipment, so she sounds closer and more intimate than ever before. And that may be part of what's shaking people when they hear it that way.
Have you heard these outtakes in which you can hear her break down, stop the music, or the control room will stop her?
Yeah.
And they'll start again? I mean, that happens to the best of them.
When I'm out in a crowd, so that people... I'm all wrong. I'm too fast now. Give me another start, please.
Okay. Make it loud. You can use it louder, can't you, lady?
Yeah, I can't hear it.
Make it louder. It still sounds the same level as before.
I can't hear that bad. I'm sorry. Oh, gee.
There's, I'm trying to think, the Argentine writer... who said of takes, he said, all literature should be like jazz takes. He said that they're not making it because, they're not doing takes again because, so much because he made mistakes, but because it can be done better. It's always better. Now, obviously, Miles Davis and a few other people thought the other way around. The first take is the best, but that's for a different reason.
I'm reckless, it's true, but what else can you do? I can hear it now.
I remember hearing it and thinking, I don't want to hear this again, but I keep listening to it.
So I walk a little too fast. And I drive.
She had moments, it seemed, when she felt deeply Hemingway's line from the 50s that a person can be destroyed and not defeated. On her hospital deathbed in Manhattan, 1959, Billie Holiday, with wry humor to the end, was said to have cracked that she had used heroin for 15 years off and on and lived longer than her mother or her father, who never touched the stuff.
And I laughed a little too much.
Someone asked me, did I see her in a different light? And I said, yeah, I thought she was far smarter, far funnier, and far tougher than anyone had ever said. And very few people mentioned it was funny. She was hysterically funny. She was... You know, on her deathbed, she was doing shticks. I mean, it was, you couldn't write material like she was doing. She also had incredible taste. I mean, this is a person who knew when she hadn't done her best and was quick to say so. There was no guile there. I mean, she's not telling everything she knows about herself, I think, but maybe she doesn't know those things about herself. Maybe we think we know them. Maybe it's you writing that song rather than me. You know, it's in the receiver, and the audience's role is very important with her and always has been. And she said she counted on audiences to carry her.
John Sweat is among the many who feel Billie Holiday saved her best for last. It was a love duet In a rare jazz special on American television, CBS 1957, she was on her last legs. So was her estranged bandmate from 20 years before, the tenor saxophonist Lester Young. It was Lester who first called Billy Lady Day at a time when African-American women were not addressed as ladies. Billy, in turn, called Lester the name that stuck, Prez, as in President of the Saxophone. He could barely stand for his 12-measure solo on the blues tune that they had done in the 30s, Fine and Mellow. But the video stands on YouTube and elsewhere for depth and truth of feeling that only the greatest musicians reach. Star-crossed people, love and death in a contest of improvisation.
My man don't love me. He treats me oh so mean. My man, he don't love me. He treats me awful mean. He's the lowest man that I've ever seen.
We listen to this now for the love affair, musically, surely, with Lester Young.
The amazing thing is that they had anything to do with each other because she was so angry at him.
Right, they had...
He had a falling out 3 years before and had spoken together all the time.
Right.
And he was dying, but so was she.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's Romeo and Juliet.
Star-crossed lovers.
That's what they said on the publicity material for the album. It was a special moment. And it's hard to attribute it to anyone, to say it was this person's smart move or whatever. The dice were rolling right for once, the cosmic dice.
He wears high-draped pants, stripes are in yellow. When he starts in to love me, he is so fine and mellow.
Thanks to our talented singers, Dee Dee Bridgewater, Dominic Eid, Marissa Nadler, Janice Pendarvis, and Rebecca Sullivan. Special thanks to John Sweat. His new book, From Biking, is called Billie Holiday, The Musician and the Myth. You can find music from this show and lots more audio online at radioopensource.org, including our own brief history of the microphone. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, with help from Max Larkin, Zach Goldhammer, and Pat Tomeno. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
Make you stay out all night long.